Good morning. It's good to be back with all of you. We're going to be looking, continuing the lessons that we started last time I was here on Psalm 23. So I'd invite you to open your Bible, your Bibles to Psalm 23, and we'll be reading from that in just a moment. I mentioned a couple months ago, I guess now, that since moving here, one of the things that I've been doing is studying with atheists and skeptics. And one of the things that I do whenever I have these discussions is to help somebody understand that if they're going to reject the Christian worldview, that it's going to bring harm into your life. Just like if somebody decides to not believe in gravity anymore, and they think they can jump off a mountain or a large hill or something, that you're going to get hurt. And I believe that Christianity is true just like gravity is true, just like diet and exercise help people and things like this. And so any rejection of this worldview is going to end up bringing some kind of harm into your life. It may not be perceptible right away, but eventually you'll see it. When I think about Psalm 23, one of the things that I reflect on are all the things that you don't have if the Lord is not your shepherd. One of those things that David says in this text is that because the Lord is his shepherd, which is what we looked at last time, the Lord is my shepherd, as a result, I shall not want. How many of you this morning could say that because the Lord is your shepherd, I have no wants? And what does that mean? I know that one of the things that I want is to be able to say that more and more for myself in a totally authentic way. That we all fight this battle of worldliness in understanding the spiritual blessings that the Lord has given us. Do we perceive these things so well that we can say, I shall not want? I want to go ahead and read Psalm 23 and try to break down this concept. We're narrowing in really just on the second part of verse 1, but I want to read the whole psalm to get it at the forefront of our minds. Look at Psalm 23, a psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I think one of the keys to understanding what David means when he says, I shall not want, is to define what this word want means. The word for want means something like to be lacking or to be needy. And there's a couple different times that this Hebrew word is used in other parts of the Old Testament. For example, do you remember in 1 Kings chapter 17 when Elijah goes to the widow and she's got this jar of oil that he says will not go empty? The word for empty is the same word for want. It's the same Hebrew word. So one way that you can understand this concept of being in want means that, like, your cup is empty. There's nothing there. Well, here's another time that this word is used. In Genesis chapter 8, verse 5, this is talking about the flood and when the water started to, as this version says, recede. The word that's underlined here is the same word for want. Look at Genesis 8, verse 5. The water continued to recede until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were visible. All right, notice the difference between these two ideas here. If the first one in 1 Kings 17 was like this cup that was just empty, that means that it's already been emptied out, there's nothing in it. But here in Genesis chapter 8, this word is used in a positive sense because land is being visible again, but it gives us a picture of what the word means. That the waters were continually emptying out. It was continually receding. So the idea of this is that to be in want could mean that you have nothing, or you have something, but you perceive that it's gradually going away more and more and more. Those are the concepts. Now, when David says, that I shall not want. You see that everything he's saying here is the opposite. That because the Lord's my shepherd, I'm not empty. Because the Lord's my shepherd, I'm not receding. There's nothing that's getting worse over time. By the way, how many things in our human experience get worse over time? You get a new computer, and it's going to start to get slower and slower and slower with time. You get a new car, and you park it far away from everybody else so that it doesn't get a dent, but somehow, some way, it eventually gets its first dent or its first scratch, and you're frustrated. All the things in this life just get worse and worse with time. This is why we need a new iPhone every 10 months or whatever it is. Whenever we're always being introduced to new and better things because the things that we have are getting worse and worse. One of the things that the Bible teaches, and one, some of the hymns that we sing, sweeter as the years go by, it's not just that we're full, but we're full to overflowing. What is it that David says in verse 5 of this psalm? That his cup runs over? You've got this same picture here that it's not just that, oh yeah, I'm full and it's staying full. It's so full that it's going over and it's in abundance. All right, that's the concept of what David is saying here. Now, as you look at this and as we continue to flesh this out a little bit more, can you say so far that you understand this? That because the Lord's my shepherd, I am satisfied. And because the Lord is my shepherd, I continually can't even know how to express all the joy that I have because of what I have in him. Now, let's say a little bit more about this, though. There's a couple things that this does not mean. As soon as you start talking about the concepts of contentment, or you talk about the concepts of being satisfied in the Lord, there might be a couple things that people say, well, does it mean that or does it mean this? There's a couple things that it doesn't mean. Whenever I have thought through Psalm 23, I've tried to think about some of the other psalms that David wrote and how some of the other psalms that David wrote will use some of the same words or concepts that we see here in Psalm 23. And here's a couple things that David also wrote that we know does not mean he's content. In other words, because he's content, somebody might think, well, that must have meant this or must have meant this. Well, here's a couple of them. It does not mean that David was complacent. Go over to Psalm 34, just a few chapters later. Look at Psalm 34, and I'm going to read verses 8 through 10 in just a moment. But somebody might think, okay, as soon as you talk about being satisfied or whatever, that means that you're just sort of coasting, that there's no proactivity. If you're satisfied with where you're at, then why keep progressing? Could be one misconception somebody could think. Look at Psalm 34, verses 8 through 10. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. You see here that in verse 10, he talks about these young lions. By the way, the young lions throughout the totality of Psalms, the young lions are inexperienced. They don't really know what they're doing. That's sort of the picture. They're like wicked and inexperienced. And it says that these young lions suffer want and hunger. That's the same word for in Psalm 23 about want. That you've got these inexperienced, and it's in contrast to somebody who in verses 8 and 9 seek the Lord and those ones will not suffer want is the picture. What is the person in this text that is filled and overflowing? Well, it's somebody who's seeking the Lord. It's somebody who's making the Lord his or her refuge. So to be satisfied, to be content, to not be in want, doesn't mean that I've gotten to this place where I'm not still hungering for the scriptures and hungering for more righteousness. Those things can actually coexist. I'm not in want, but I keep pursuing this because it's the only desire that's ever kept me satisfied and I want to keep coming back to it. Unlike a drug addiction where you keep going back to it, try to get the original feeling you once had. You keep going back to this one because it's never leaving you in want, but you want more of it because it's all positive. That's one thing that the text doesn't mean. There's another one though, is it doesn't mean that you're naive to your hurts and pains. Have you ever had this idea before that if I'm going to say that I'm content, that it must mean that I can never talk about or acknowledge anything in my life that hurts or is difficult? That's not the concept. In fact, go back to Psalm 22, the famous one that Jesus quotes from the cross. By the way, have you ever noticed how many times Jesus quotes the scripture while he's on the cross? It's like he's bleeding scripture at the end of his life. I hope that towards the end of my life, I can have this relationship with the Lord where the things that I'm speaking about are all the meditations that I've had on the Lord. This is one of the things that Jesus meditated on while he was on the cross. Look at Psalm 22, verses 1 and 2. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? From from the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. So in the very next chapter, David says, I shall not want. But in the chapter before that, in Psalm 22, he's talking about his crying and his groaning and all the things that are making him sad. If you walk away this morning thinking more about how content you have, how much contentment you have in the Lord, does that mean that for another part of the day you can't talk about anything that hurts in your life? No, that's not the idea. Here's David saying this in Psalm 22, but then in Psalm 23 he says something that might seem contradictory, but it's not. Okay, maybe another question to ask about this, though, is how is it that this good shepherd satisfied David, and how is it that the good shepherd satisfies us? So when David says that I shall not want, well, what is it that he has that makes him not being in want? Maybe part of it would be his physical needs being met. Is that part of it, like Matthew 6:33, seek the kingdom first and these things will be added to you? Is that one of the ways that God takes care of us? Is that one of the ways that God took care of the Israelites in the wilderness? Nehemiah chapter 9 verse 21, 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness and they lacked, same word in Psalm 23, they lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out and their feet did not swell. Was God their shepherd in the wilderness? There's psalms that give that imagery that God was their shepherd while the nation was in the wilderness for the 40 years. And during that time, they lacked nothing. They had food, they had clothes, they had shoes that didn't wear out, all of these different sorts of things. By the way, was David ever in the wilderness? Have you ever noticed this theme in David's life? There's two times when David is in the wilderness. The first time is when he's fleeing from King Saul, and we'll say some things about that in a little bit. When he was fleeing from King Saul after Saul was trying to chuck spears at him and frighten David in these ways, David runs, and does he handle himself perfectly in that first time? Remember, there's some things that he does pretty good where he could have killed Saul, but he refuses to. But what about that whole story with Nabal and Abigail? Doesn't seem to handle that situation very well until he listens to the wisdom of Abigail, things like this. He's also fleeing with some of the enemies and living with them and lying to them during that time. There's things during the first period that David is in the wilderness that he does not handle well. But then the second time that David is in the wilderness, it's when he's fleeing from his son Absalom. Does he handle himself a little bit better in that time? Remember Shimei, the guy that's throwing rocks at David and he's cursing David and David is not responding with vengeance? The way that David handles himself in the second wilderness shows you that he was prepared by the first to deal with circumstances like this. But in both of those situations, was God taking care of David? Did David have clothing and food? Think about this in your life. No matter how difficult things have ever been, have you always had food to eat? Have you always had clothes to wear? Might not be the fashion that you want. It might not always be the food that you'd like to eat. But has God taken care of you? Yeah, I think that would be one way that he's taking care of us, is through the physical needs. But I think this would ultimately be the spiritual blessings. One of the things that I've become more and more convicted about since becoming a preacher, I've been preaching for 11 years now. And I don't think any preacher ever really fully feels like they know exactly the right way to approach everything. But one of the things that I've seen more and more that I've become more convicted about is that one of the roles of a preacher is to encourage people, encourage a church, to help them know how good they have it in the Lord. Because one of the things that we struggle with is we look at the physical things that we don't have. We don't realize all the time that we have what we need physically. We might not have all the things that we want physically, and we might get so fixated on the physical realm that I want these things that I don't have. And one of the roles that we have for one another and that I think a preacher has for a local church is to remind people what they have in the Lord and how to appreciate that. None of us are going to be the world's wealthiest people physically. But in the Atlanta area, is it true that this group is one of the most wealthiest group of people that you could find in all of Atlanta? Is that true? Spiritually speaking? It is. How much is it, how readily apparent is that to our minds though? Ultimately, all of our spiritual needs are met. Even if we don't have all of our physical wants met. Well, think about some tests. Okay. If I was to ask myself, how do I know if I'm satisfied in the Lord? Here's a couple questions that we could ask ourselves to analyze our hearts to see where it's at. Number one, do you complain? Remember the book of Numbers, how much the Israelites were complaining? Series of seven complaints that they make between chapters 11 and 21. Just complaining, complaining, complaining about food, complaining about leadership, complaining about their jealousy that they have. Just all the time, the only thing they can do is express some kind of dissatisfaction about something. Remember when I lived in San Diego, it was so funny. When people would complain that there had been no rain, and then I kid you not, whenever it would rain, people would complain about the rain. It's just like, no matter what season, there's always something to be frustrated about. Are those the kinds of things that you constantly express as some kind of complaint? Here's another one. Are you covetous? Do you constantly see what other people have and compare yourself to what other people have, their gifts, abilities, talents, whatever it might be, and get frustrated that you don't have those things? Notice thirdly, do you worry a lot? Worry stems from an overconfidence in how you think the future ought to go. And because we can't control the future, we try to control our emotions and all this kind of stuff to feel like we've got some kind of control. We go through these little rituals of making sure that we drink this drink before the football game starts so we can try to make sure that they win the game, or I wear this color shirt. We try to do all these things to control things that we can't control. I can control these things, but there's no kind of transference to those things. Worry is just a silly thing. Doesn't make a difference. But it's one of the ways that we try to seek having control. Do we trust that God's got our best interests at heart? And that we don't need to be worrying about all the things that the world worries about? All right, those are just some things to consider about this idea of what it means to be in want or not being in want. But I want to ask another question here. What are some reasons that we might be in want? If there's anybody here this morning that's feeling like, well, I don't know that I really know what it's like to be satisfied in the Lord, I've heard about these ideas, but what does it really mean? Go over to John chapter 10. Look at John chapter 10, where Jesus talks about himself being the good shepherd, and we'll make a couple observations from this. We'll see two things in this text that might help us diagnose why we might sometimes be in want. Let's read John chapter 10 and verses 7 through 16. So Jesus again said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he shall be saved and will go in and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves, and the sheep flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep, and I have other sheep that are not of this fold, I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice, so there will be one flock, one shepherd." Stop there, okay. Alright, what's one reason in this text that you can identify why somebody might be in want, might not be satisfied? Well, one thing that you can identify here is that you can choose the wrong shepherd. You notice this contrast in this text, that Jesus being the good shepherd came so that he could give life and he could give it abundantly. But the contrast in this text is that there's the bad shepherd that steals and kills and destroys. The good shepherd, he comes to give abundant life. He provides pasture for the sheep. In verse 11, he's laying down his life for the sheep. He's doing all these sacrificial acts for the sheep. But by way of contrast, you've got the bad shepherd who's not sacrificing anything himself. He's making you sacrifice more and more and more and more. Do you know what life is like if you've chosen the wrong shepherd? By the way, all of us are following something. Everybody's a slave to something. The Bible teaches that in Romans 6. The thing that matters is the quality of your master. I'll take a dictator any day if it's Jesus Christ. It's all about the character of the leader, right? What is life like if you've chosen the wrong leader? Well, in this text, it describes this bad leader as stealing, killing, and destroying. I've had a lot of conversations with preachers and Christians since I've become a Christian. And there are certain conversations that have really added a lot to my understanding of how I should serve the Lord, things like this. There was one day when I was in Minnesota and there was a guy that came up to me and he was older. And these are his words, not mine. And he said, "Hey, Eric, do you know why there's so many old cranky people?" I said, "No, I don't know why there's so many old cranky people, but can you tell me why?" And he said, "Well, not every old person needs to become cranky, but the reason that some people get old and cranky is because when they were young, they made their God something that age would eventually take away from them. Like sports." Well, if you make your God how strong you are in your sports, things like this. Do you suppose when you get older, you're not going to be able to play those sports very well anymore? What if you make music your God? And you really like listening to different kinds of music and all this sort of thing. You like playing instruments and all this. Are your fingers going to be getting to a point one day where they can't really play the way that they used to be able to play? Are your ears going to get to a point where you can't really hear the way that you used to be able to hear? What if you're a foodie and you like finding the best food no matter where you go? What's going to happen to your teeth someday? Ecclesiastes 11 and 12 talk about this process of getting older. What about making intellect your God? I remember it was the week that my family moved to Atlanta. My grandpa passed away. My grandpa worked for Ronald Reagan. And he spent time with all these really important people in Washington, D.C. My mom grew up in Maryland, all this kind of stuff. And when I was growing up, when I went to high school, I started getting breakfast with him a couple times a month. And just his perception on things, he was this important psychologist, he just had such good wisdom about, earthly wisdom about so many things. And in the years leading up to his death, the only thing that he could acknowledge, even when I would bring my firstborn son to him, he would go, "Eric, is that you? Do I have a great grandson now?" Like just not being able to recognize much of anything. What happens if I make my greatest pursuit intellect and wisdom and learning more things every day, which that's fine to do that. Do you know what age is going to do? It's going to take all of that away from you. If I make anything other than Jesus my shepherd, age will strip away my God and it's going to leave me bitter and angry. Do you see how everything else gets worse with time? Maybe you're older, maybe you're younger. But whatever it is that you like to put a lot of meaning in, if it's not Jesus, it will be taken away from you in this life. The bad shepherd, what does it do? It steals, it kills, it destroys, it makes you feel more and more diminished. Have you chosen the wrong shepherd? Do you know what it's like to be in want because you've chosen the wrong shepherd? There's another reason in this text, though, why you might be in want. And it might be because you've been isolated from the flock. You notice how Jesus talks in this text about his sheep, this idea of this plural group of people that are together in verse 16. There's other sheep that he's got to bring into his fold. Part of this abundant community in this text in John 10, none of it is shared by an individual sheep and that sheep alone. Do you see any Lone Ranger sheep in this text? If they try to go out and be all by themselves, then they kind of get away from the flock that gets corporately nurtured by this good shepherd. We were created to be in relationship with other people. Do you suppose that this last year, with this isolation and COVID and all this kind of stuff, do you suppose we've lost some of the joy that we had because of the relationships we're supposed to have with each other? I think about 2 John verse 12. Though I have much to write... By the way, have you ever thought about... Why is the letter of 2 John so short? What's the reason it's so short? Well, the reason is right here in verse 12. Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk to you face to face so that our joy may be complete. He's writing such a short letter because he says, look, I don't want to write a long letter right now. I'd rather just be with you in person so that our joy can be complete. If I try to be a Christian on a lone island somewhere and just enjoy me and Jesus, do you realize that there's still going to be something missing? You can't fully enjoy something until you can enjoy it in community with other people. If you find a really good restaurant, can you keep it to yourself or do you have to talk to other people about it? If you find a really good band or a really good whatever thing that you really like, it's like you can't learn to enjoy it until you've evangelized that great thing you've found, and then your joy can be complete when other people are enjoying the same thing. You know what I mean by that? All right. I want to finish this lesson out by considering a couple things about how we can grow in our contentment in the Lord. Go to 1 Samuel 18, and we'll be in that text in just a moment. 1 Samuel 18. But I want to help us think through this by beginning with part of the chapter that was in the scripture reading. Philippians 4 verses 11 and 12 says, "Now that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and how to abound. In every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." Notice here that somebody might look at Paul and say, okay, Paul, well, you were just kind of one of those like ultra spiritual people and you understood how to be just really content in the Lord, all this kind of stuff. In verse 11, Paul says that I had to learn this secret of being content. The secret in verse 12 of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. There he's talking about finances. I learned how to still be content when I was rich. By the way, are there struggles with being content when you're rich? Yeah, because the temptation would be to want more and more and more, right? Are there struggles to be content when you're poor? Yeah, obviously there would be for that. In either situation, whether you're rich or poor, it's hard to learn how to be content. But somehow, some way, Paul learned this. Now, what would be some of the secrets that would teach us how to be content? Number one is to stop comparing. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 6 through 9. This is after David has killed Goliath. And this is, we're going to narrow in on Saul's jealousy for David. But look at verses 6 through 9. "As they were coming home when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the woman came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines and songs of joy and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, 'Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s.' And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?' And Saul eyed David from that day on." All right, this text is interesting. Because did you notice how much attention is still given to Saul? All these women with the tambourines and everything, who are they coming out to meet? The text says they were coming out to meet Saul, the king. And then when they come out to Saul the king, they're singing praises to Saul, and then they're also saying, yeah, David's also killed his 10,000s, but they're coming out to meet Saul. They're praising Saul. And Saul hears that somebody's being exalted above him, or somebody's being acknowledged above him, and rather than Saul being grateful that this guy brought victory to the nation, and these people still appreciate me as the leader. No, no, no. Instead, he's worried that he's going to have the kingdom taken away from him, which he does eventually because of his own jealousy. Did you notice, though, in verse 9, that in this jealousy that he has, that David is getting eyed by Saul? Saul's got so much displeasure over this comparison. By the way, can we ever do this comparison business? Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. It's a good title, isn't it? The Coddling of the American Mind. And what the book is about how weak-minded people in our society have become. And we're fragile to criticism, we're fragile to so many different kinds of things. And one of the things that he says has especially affected people, I grew up before the smartphone. I don't know what it would be like for an 8-year-old to have a smartphone. I don't know what it would be like for a 12-year-old or a 16-year-old to have a smartphone. But if they've got social media, and they got TikTok, and they've got Facebook, and they've got, even though Facebook's for the older people now and how it's viewed, Instagram and all these things, and they're constantly looking at all the best things other people have. Like, have you ever posted something on social media when you're at your worst? Like, here's me yelling at my kids, and I'm ashamed of this moment, but here it is. Nobody's going to post that. People are only going to post things that look really perfect and pretty and pristine. And what happens when you're scrolling through these kinds of things all day long? Could there be a tendency to compare? How come their life seems so much happier than mine? How come their life is so much more beautiful than mine? How come they're always getting new, better things than the things that I have? It seems like everything in my house is always breaking. Why do they have just all this perfection? And you're scrolling through, seeing all this kind of stuff all day long. Do you suppose that that could cause you to be in want? Romans 12:15, rejoice with those who rejoice. What if we could do that instead? Instead of looking at all this bitterness. By the way, that book, The Coddling of the American Mind, one of the things that it argues is that if you're constantly on social media, it's one of the biggest reasons for depression in our society, especially amongst young girls, ironically. And so, is there anything that you're comparing yourself to others with? By the way, in this text, do you notice that there's a comparison with numbers? Saul is struck down as thousands, David as 10,000s. Do we ever compare with regards to numbers about anything? This person makes more money. This person has more talent. This person has more friends. This church is larger. This person has more whatever it could be. And you're constantly thinking about numbers, numbers, numbers. And it causes you to not be able to rejoice about anything. Maybe you compare yourself to the other gifts and abilities that people have. Maybe it's to the success that somebody else has. Maybe it's to the character that somebody else has. And either way, rather than looking at that and going, you know what, that urges me to get better. The person that's comparing in a bitter way looks at that and it makes them retract and get more and more bitter. There's a difference between looking at something that you perceive to be more mature than you in some way and going, that makes me want to strive more. Versus looking at it and going, I'm going to crawl up into my cave and get more and more mad. That's what Saul did. That's the first suggestion. Just stop comparing. And if you see a blessing that somebody else has, rejoice with those who rejoice. That's a command, not a suggestion. Notice, though, another thing that would help us learn to have contentment in the Lord. And that's to meditate on blessings. What are the things that you actively think about? Paul says this in Philippians 4, verse 8. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What is it that Paul is doing here? That you sort of see David doing in Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. What's David meditating on? How good the Lord has been to him. Yeah, but David, are you blind? Do you look at how rough your life is? You've been in the wilderness. People have been trying to kill you. Your sons are wicked people trying to harm each other. David, look at your life. And then David says in Psalm 23, this is what's true spiritually for me. He wasn't naive to his hurts and pains, but what David was thinking about were the blessings that he had. Have you ever just stopped and taken a journal out? An empty piece of paper, and done two lines, or like a line down the middle, two columns. One column, what are the ways that I've been taking care of physically? What are the ways that I've been taking care of spiritually? And just write those things down. When was the last time you did something like that, at least mentally? And if you haven't done it mentally, then maybe this afternoon force yourself to do it physically on a piece of paper. And it might be easier to think through all the physical things that you have, but meditate more. This is why you have to meditate. You have to think more and more and more. What are the spiritual blessings that I have? What do those things mean to me? Can I help myself realize how good I have it in the Lord so that I can find this contentment that's so elusive in our society? I read it. What, you know those stories that old preachers share that you're like, you hear it and you're like, I don't know if that really happened or not. It might just be an old preacher story to make a good point. I got one of those stories and I think it's one of those ones that was made up to make a good point. So I read a story about a man who was having a lot of financial struggles. And he went to the elders of the congregation and he went to the elders and he said, I have lost everything. And the elder responded, I'm so sorry that you've lost your faith. And the man said, no, I haven't lost my faith. And he said, well, the elder continued and said, I'm sorry that you've lost your character. So sorry about that. And the man responded by saying, I did not lose my character. And the elder said, I'm really sorry you've lost your salvation then, because you're telling me that you've lost everything. And for the last time, the man said, that's not what I said. And the elder said, well, if you have your faith and your character and your salvation, I don't know why you're saying that you've lost everything. Where's your focus? Can you say that because the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want? I heard a story about a preacher that was in Africa. And there was a poor family there. And they were especially poor compared to even other people in this part of Africa. And some neighbors were making fun of them for how poor they were. And this young man in the family responded by saying, we're not poor, we just have no money. It was a Christian. The family was a Christian. It was a Christian family. Oh, that we could have that perspective. That we would see more and more that I have meaning in God. I have identity in Him. I've got a hope that nothing in this world can take. But all these people in the world that seem to have all these things that sometimes I wish I had, their age is going to strip all of that away from them, and one day it's all going to be burned. If you could, you know those packaging labels that you can put on things for when you're moving and stuff like this? What if on all of your most prized possessions, you could put a sticker that says, soon to be burned, soon to be burned, soon to be burned, soon to be burned? You know that that's true, right? When Jesus comes back, it's all going to go up in flames. And the thing that's going to be purified is the precious faith that's like gold of His saints. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. We're about to sing this song, Let Him Have His Way With Thee. Maybe you haven't been letting Him have His way with you. Maybe you've been fighting against it. Maybe you've been choosing the wrong shepherd. If you let Him have His way with you, and you test it, and you live it out, you'll see that it's so much better than all the shepherds that steal and kill and destroy. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.